Welcome to Pap Talk, a podcast from Contemporary OBGYN, where we deliver expert insight, commentary, and more on emerging topics and trends for doctors in women's health.
Why do you believe, from your expertise, that patients struggle in silence, and what can practitioners do to begin these sometimes difficult conversations with their patients?
You know, I think there's a lot of issues that surround a patient who has chronic pelvic pain. Firstly, there's barriers on the patient side. They're embarrassed. They feel that their sexuality, their sexual health is deprioritized by their healthcare professional. They're embarrassed. They don't know what words to use. They don't know what the provider's reaction will be. And on the flip side, healthcare professionals also are ill-equipped with poor screening techniques, poor skills with physical exam. And again, they don't want to misrepresent or misunderstand what is going on. And sexuality is very often a challenging topic. You know, professionals have issues before they become providers. They may have their own sexual hangups. There's issues about time. There's issues about complexity. There's issues about billing as well. So I think there is a very big disconnect. And I think if professionals wait for patients to talk about sexuality, they're going to be waiting and waiting and waiting, and there's going to be no forthcoming discussions. I think that the onus is really on the professionals to normalize the situation, understand that sexual health and general health are very much intertwined, and intimacy issues are becoming more and more of a concern, especially now when we're in close quarters and we're quarantining and we're only seeing, you know, a very few select group of people. I think intimacy concerns are bubbling to the surface. In addition, patients also need to get prepared. They should be marking down questions that they will ask their provider. They can practice. And again, I always say a good healthcare professional is not afraid of a second opinion. So if your provider is not addressing your needs in totality, including your sexual wellness, then it's okay to find others that will address those issues.
Yeah, and especially if it's important to the patient and they're willing to talk about it. I think that's a whole other level, a whole other psychological level. That can be a barrier for some, but when they are willing to talk about it, they deserve to have that healthcare professional who is open about it.
So, and again, I just want to reiterate that it's okay if the professional is uncomfortable not dealing with sexual health issues. And it's okay if they discover an issue, but they feel ill-equipped. But they should develop a network of referrals where these patients can get, you know, safe, effective treatment in a comfortable environment. And just like an OBGYN may not be very comfortable with managing hypertension or diabetes or thyroid dysfunction, they refer these patients out to endocrinologists. So should an OBGYN have special interest in minimally invasive surgery or primarily a laborist or an obstetrician, and they don't deal with these issues, nor do they have any interest or background or training, that's perfectly reasonable to say, well, look, I recognize this is an issue. It's important that we address it. And here is a list of providers, whether they're other OBGYNs, other medical professionals, physical therapists, psychologists, therapists, that can certainly help you address this important concern. So a referral is not a failure. It's really about looking at the patient in totality and looking at the intricacies and really validating their concerns and listening.
So we know from your article, the vaginal dilators issues and answers that appeared earlier this year in Sexual Medicine Reviews, that, and you've addressed this somewhat, but that the patients also have a difficult time finding these clinicians who are well-versed in sexual pain syndromes that can help them. So how does an OBGYN, a general practitioner, that you, just like you've addressed, begin to build those networks and those referral system?
Well, there's a whole variety of organizations, including genital pelvic floor physical therapists. There's the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, or ASECT, which addresses the psychological needs. There's also subgroups like the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, ISSM, the International Society. And again, there are even pelvic pain societies as well. So for patients, very often they're going online and looking and getting connected with the community, whether it's by blogs or chats or other organizations. I think it's very important. In addition, providers can develop that network as well. Even in their own community, there may be an OBGYN champion that addresses pelvic pain as well. So looking at your immediate colleagues, I'm in Southern California and I have a very large referral basis from other OBGYNs currently in the field, but they don't have an interest or desire to manage these complex patients.
Okay. What are some of the more, just from your perspective, what are some of the largest percentage of cases? What are they due to? Are they, we talk about, vaginal atrophy, postmenopause, from your expert perspective and what you've seen in your practice, what are the majority?
Just understanding that I have a little bit of a different and unique perspective. I run a high-risk breast ovarian center in two locations. So very often we have a large subgroup of chemotherapy-induced menopause, early menopause, surgical menopause. And we also have women who have just natural menopause. So I think this totality of cancer-induced changes in the vaginal health, as well as genitourinary syndrome of menopause, are pretty much a large subgroup. But in addition, we really should not forget there's over 300 medications that cause vaginal dryness. It's not uncommon for younger women to have vaginal dryness, pain, and then subsequent disconnect between the brain and body, where the body is almost reflexively contracting. And, when the brain is anxious, there's, even an overlap with arousal issues when women are not aroused or they're distracted and they're not engaging in a variety of activities that help them stimulate their natural lubrication, they may experience painful intercourse, and that subsequently leads to a cascade. So there's a lot of other issues, medication-induced, age as the ovaries stop working, and then iatrogenic are things that we cause, whether it's by surgery, radiation, or chemo, we affect the tissues directly and indirectly as well.
And so, the other obstacles too that you addressed, the poorly, again, with the use of vaginal dilators, there's a huge option of materials and types of dilators. Can you talk about those options first? And then we can go into the next question about the poorly defined intervals, the limited dilator sizes. Do you want to address that a little bit?
Right, and I'll address those in conjunction when choosing dilators and dilator programs. And there will be another article coming out shortly in the hopefully in the Journal of Sexual Medicine. It's under second review at the current time. But it was one of the largest surveys which looked at the difference between static dilators, which are dilators that have a variety of different sizes, and then a continuous dilator, which was this electronic dilator that increases by 1 millimeter at a time. And again, there is a lot of different materials, whether it's glass, whether it's hard plastic, whether it's medical grade, latex, latex-free, whether they're pliable or whether they're firm, and the variety of sizes that they come in. So, you know, static dilators are kind of like walking up steps. It's one step and then you go, keep going further and further up, and you have to transition from one size to the next. The gradual dilator, which is kind of the next generation, which is the milli, is really like a conveyor belt. It increases by 1 millimeter at a time electronically. Mm-hmm. There are some characteristics that are coming out in the literature that we know that are better. Patients' compliance is a very big issue. So if we overprescribe, patients tend to underdeliver. So the sweet spots tends to be about 3 to 4 times a week, 15 minutes. The myth was dispelled that we thought that early morning was better than late afternoon or evening. And again, that's really patient dependent, the time where they can find privacy. We know that women like to set the stage. They want to have privacy to do their dilators. They don't want to be interrupted, which has become much more challenging with a full household and full Zoom calls and tight quarters, which are really challenging today in today's day and age. But we know when they're doing activities like listening to music or having relaxation candles or reading a book, they tend to be more compliant. Also, we know that they enjoy the vibration theory, vibration aspect of a dilator. So again, I think it's important to not be a lumper and say everybody should have, you know, static versus gradual dilators. I think it's really important to individualize, talk to your patients, see what they need. And very often it's in conjunction. And I can tell you, sometimes I have women start with a Q-tip and then they move, progress to a very small static dilator, and then they transition to a different one. Some women want to start with, just hard dilators that are limited in size. Others want a gradual transition, so the milli would be perfect for them. Yeah. And again, the other issue is cost. There's a whole range of cost, and cost doesn't necessarily correlate with effectiveness. So there's no real good data to support that one dilator is better than the other. We know that, it's really expert opinion, 3 to 4 times a week, 15 minute session. We know that the literature supports close follow-up, close surveillance is an important aspect for success with your dilator. So I have an aggressive dilator program. Every woman gets, vaginal rehab with moisturizers, lubricants, maybe a hormone, and they get the tissues healthy. Then they have a dilator program, which they institute. And sometimes slow and steady wins the race. They transition from one size to the next very slowly, or one increment slowly. Other people progress more frequently. And again, we see them pretty regularly, every 4 to 6 weeks, depending on their needs, just because sometimes there's, two steps forward, one step back, so there may be setbacks. And again, dilators are an important part of the overall paradigm. So we talked about moisturizers, lubricants, vaginal hormones to reverse the mucosal effects. In addition, there's other medications that are not necessarily approved. They're not FDA approved, like intravaginal Valium, topical lidocaine at the opening. Those may also be very, very effective in the overall treatment. So think of dilators as one of many layers that you're using in order to help facilitate and treat this chronic pain.
And then also the other part of it that I would like to talk about and get your take on it too is working with a transgender patient.
Yeah, and I mean, I think those are, you know, those patients are very, very interesting. They come with their own set of challenges in terms of hormonal balance and side effects and psychosocial issues. But again, the importance of maintaining that physician-patient therapeutic alliance with open communication. And, you know, the added benefit that we should all be doing, we should have cultural sensitivity in our offices. We should be examining the forms that we give to our patients and make sure they are appropriate with appropriate questions and even a preferred name. I think that's very important to recognize, and we need to train our staff. You know, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. Yes. And I think all patients should be treated fairly, equally, and the same in terms of their unique medical needs. So dilators certainly are a very important part of, you know, transgender patients, and they may have unique and special needs, but I think we need to be sensitive to all of our patients as well.
Now, how have the options changed over the past 5 to 10 years? Can you talk about that too? Have they, you know, has
well,
you talked about
I think, yeah. Well, I think the issues related to the dilator choices have changed. There's a multitude of them, whether they're static, whether they're hard, you know, colors, sizes, different materials. And again, people are becoming much more cost conscious, you know, and again, there's high tech, there's vibration features, some could be cold, some could be hot. And again, I think we need to individualize. And until we have more substantial data, most of the stuff that we're doing is based upon expert opinion. What we've seen in, you know, what I've seen over the 20 years of being in the sexual medicine business, consulting with other experts in the field, working for design and development of newer ergodynamic products, really will all help the patient and improve compliance. And, you know, there is that article on dilators and sexual medicine reviews, which kind of gives you a whole gamut of the options and choices of dilators that are out there, when they're used, how they're used. And again, I think the big issue is, you know, we're not underutilizing a cast when a person breaks their arm, or underutilizing a sling if they need that. This is a medical equipment that needs to be incorporated as part of the therapeutic paradigm. And again, if you're not comfortable discussing them, then refer out. And again, I think in the last 5 years, we've seen really a big movement in terms of patient education and support and research and design in order to help facilitate and improve compliance. Remember, it is a very big issue that people get frustrated and they don't want to continue. So if we can develop products that are much more user-friendly, I think we'll be ahead of the game as well.
Yeah. And is there anything else that you would like to add, especially in the time of a pandemic, how these types of issues might be human behavior to sweep them under the rug?
Right. And I think the big issue that the message that I have for healthcare professionals is ask. You can't treat a problem if you don't know that one exists. And sexual health and general health are very much intertwined. And people are really struggling right now. And they're making decisions about whether or not to go to the clinician or not. You know, telehealth visits are up. And again, it is an important topic of your overall general health. Normalize it, you know, and I basically say I ask every patient about their intimacy and their relationship and if they're having pain, because it's important for their overall general health and well-being. So ask would be the biggest message to healthcare professionals. And for patients, I think the other big issue is tell. Your healthcare provider is not a mind reader. Have the courage to talk about things that are very important for you. Practice, write them down, and do your homework. And if you haven't been able to have those issues addressed, there are numerous healthcare professionals, allied healthcare professionals, pain specialists that are willing and interested and more than forthcoming in terms of treating these sexual health concerns for you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Pap Talk. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.